Okay, here is that outline we just mentioned. We're on this second section right here, and we're actually in chapter 5 now, trying to understand the providential rule of God. So, and this section is from chapter 3 through chapter 5. So in chapter 3, we looked at the admissions that Solomon made about the truths that are unalterable. They are there whether we admit them or not, but he admitted them. Then he also posed questions regarding, even though those things are true, he asked those questions, well, why is there oppression? Why is there rivalry among men? Why is there injustice? Those kinds of things. We talked about all those. And now this is the section we're in right here, the dangers that he's warning about if one yields to those questions. And we got into this one. This is where we left off class last week, verses 1 through 7 of chapter 5. If one yields to these questions and starts causing doubts in his or her mind, it could lead to improper worship. And you notice there as the chapter begins when he says, guard your steps as you go to the house of God and draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools. So be not hasty in your words. Verse 2, the difference is that God is in heaven, we're on the earth. This vast difference between heaven and the earth and deity and man is certainly argues for the fact that we need to be conscious of God and our own unworthiness and the superior nature that He has above us. This is the last slide we looked at last week. Not only must we guard our steps, but the passage tells us to guard our lips or guard our mouth. So be careful how you go to worship, but then be careful the kind of worship that you offer once you get there. And we looked at Matthew 6 and verse 7, in relation to this, to kind of get a New Testament example, I think, of what Solomon's talking about. Verse 7 of Ecclesiastes 5, in many dreams and in many words there is emptiness. So man, as a general rule, thinks the more words that he says, what is he doing to his message? He thinks, if I say more, yeah, it'll mean more. Yeah. Eventually, I'll say something right in all the things that I say. And so the emphasis is quantity. You know, the more I say, but that's not quality. And Jesus rebuked the Pharisees in that New Testament passage. They think they will be heard for their many words, he says. So therefore, when you pray, do not use vain or meaningless repetitions. Seems to fall in line with this general warning that Solomon's giving us here. So one danger, he says, is the danger of offering improper worship. This gets us to the bottom of page 12. Now, this is question 24. So, he continues now saying, here's my advice. Look at verses 4 through 7 of Ecclesiastes 5. When you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it, for He takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Do not let your speech cause you to sin, and do not say in the presence of the messenger of God that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For in many dreams and in many words there is emptiness. And we'll save the last part of verse 7 for just in a moment. So, his advice. If you're going to speak, if you're going to make a vow to God, what ought to be your intentions? I'm going to pay it. I promise. I make this. If it's a promise, it's a vow, it's a pledge, it's an oath, whatever, however you want to look at it. I make this verbal commitment to God. I need to have the intention of paying. In fact, he says it's better to what? Not make it than to make it and have no intention of paying. It's better not to vow than to vow and then not pay. It's a sin to vow. Look at verse 6. It's a sin to vow and then later say what? Oh, I didn't mean that. Change my mind. It's a mistake. In fact, what's it going to produce by the end of verse 6? What idea do you get? What's it going to result in? The wrath of God. Yes. He says, why should God be angry on your account or on account of your voice? And destroy the work of your hands, that is to say, your worship, what you're offering. So it only invites, to do that, only invites the wrath of God and angers Him against you. And of course, we certainly don't want to be in that predicament. We don't want to have the Lord, His wrath pointed at us. So, what is the solution? Last part of verse 7. He says, rather, and then it's just two words. Fear God. Reverence God. Fear God. So if a person comes to the house of God, if he's going to offer the Lord this worship, if this is his guiding principle, whatever I do in worship, and let's make it personal. We came here 2 days ago. We'll come back again tomorrow night. And if the Lord keeps tarrying, we'll come back next Sunday and then the Wednesday and Sunday and all that. When we assemble in this room, what's our purpose? It's to worship, it's to fear, it's to reverence God. Now, how do we know what kind of worship to offer? You go across all of this town, can't you, and you see all different kinds of worship. So how's that going to be determined? That's whatever's in His Word, that's right. We need to render to worship, render to God the kind of worship that He has said that He wants. Any other kind doesn't reverence Him, it doesn't revere Him, it doesn't honor Him. It honors the one who makes up the unacceptable worship. Because now we're doing things the way that He wants them done rather than the way that God wants them done. So there's the solution. If you want to avoid the danger of offering God improper worship, the first thing to do is to fear Him. And that doesn't just mean be afraid of Him. That would be included, yes. But not just fear, but rather be in awe of Him. To revere who He is. Again, look back to... what's the verse again? The last part of verse 2. He's where and we're where. He's in heaven. We're on the earth. That sets the stage for giving Him the reverence and the fear and the awe that He deserves. So that's how we can avoid this danger of improper worship. Reverencing the name of God and having fear of Him. Now, look at verses 8 through 9. This gets up to the top of page 13. Here's a second danger I believe Solomon talks about, and that is the danger of losing faith. And you don't actually see those words in these verses, I know. But if we look at them, I think that's really what he's talking about. Verses 8 and 9. If you see oppression of the poor, and he's talked about that some already, back in chapter 4. If you see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province, that is to say, out here in the kingdom, ruled by the civil authorities, do not be shocked at the sight, for one official watches over another official. And there are higher officials over them. When he says, don't be shocked, don't be alarmed, what's he in reality telling us if you see these things? Why the admonition, don't be shocked? It's a common thing. Don't let that destroy your faith. Because isn't this one of the main arguments against God? If the world was ruled by an all-powerful and all-loving and all-knowing God, then why are there such things as oppression, injustice? Why are people hurt? Why are people killed? Why are all these things? That's an argument used against the existence of God. And that can lead one, if he buys into that, that can lead one to eventually do what? No God, no faith, no belief. I have no compulsion now to believe that He is, that He exists and that He rules. Sovereignly rules the world. And so Solomon says, don't be shocked at this. Don't lose your faith even though you see these puzzling things. Because we do see them. They are in the world not because God wants them there, but because He allows them to be in the world by giving man free choice to be the oppressor, to be the one who takes away justice, to be unfair, those kinds of activities. That's all up to us. We decide that. And God lets us have that choice. Look how the last part of verse 8 is worded. When he says that do not be afraid, what's the reminder he gives us that may serve as a check and balance to this? That's right. Everybody's got a boss. You answer to somebody. You answer to somebody. So the one who is the oppressor, well, he doesn't own the world. So he may be the king. He may be the one who's over the province. But even if he's the king, he's got somebody over him. He may not recognize it. He's got somebody over him, though. Or it could be somebody, you know, further down the ladder there. Different bureaucratic levels of government. Somebody answers to him, he answers to him, and so forth. Solomon reminds us, for one official watches over another. And kind of in a general sense, the last part of verse 8, and there are higher officials over them. So all must answer to the sovereign God. Eventually, that's where we go with this line of authority. It all points back to the Father. So, How do we keep faith when we see things like he's mentioning here? How do we not lose our faith? By remembering this. He controls it all. He still allows it to happen, though, in life. But how do we rectify that in our minds? We see people being treated unfairly. We've seen, in our culture, we've seen, my personal opinion is, we've seen elections stolen. I mean, we've seen that. And wrong people put in power. We've seen corruption, we've seen abuse of power, we've seen all these things, politically or civilly speaking. That can lead a person, if he or she wanted to just easily, well, why even try? Why even, you know, it's all crooked anyway. But how do we maintain our perspective? One unalterable fact here. In the end, he will judge. In the end, God will judge. Now, the fairness may not come back around in this life. They may go to their grave thinking that they've succeeded in getting what they wanted. But there's the judgment day. And that's where we, of course, the Scripture leads us in that direction. Verse 9 is interesting, and some versions may read differently. My version reads this way: a king who cultivates his field is an advantage to the land. Now, what in the world does that mean? Somebody says. What's that got to do with what he's talking about here? A king who cultivates his field is an advantage to the land. Does that mean the king's out there with the plow? I don't think so. Kings don't plow the land. They got somebody else to do it for them. Well, that's true. The proper use of the land will benefit all those who are involved in it. That's correct. But this first part of the phrase, the king who cultivates the land. Could there be someone who rules, and I think the context here is talking about civil authority, civil rule. Could there be someone who rules civilly, who tries to keep himself distant, tries to stay above the fray of all things that are involved? And some rule that way, because they see themselves aloof, they see themselves as better than those that they rule. I think what Solomon's saying is a supreme ruler, or a king, a ruler, who is actively involved in ruling his own domain, that is, he's plowing his own land in a figure of speech. If you have such a ruler, then what are the chances? What happened to the chances of things like oppression and injustice and unfairness? Do they totally go away? Probably not. But would they be somewhat diminished if he's actively involved? Now, I think that's what he's cautioning here. So for those who have aspirations of ruling or having those positions of authority, the warning here is you need to be the king who plows his own land. You need to be involved in those things. And those who are ruled, they need to pray for such a ruler. What if they don't have such a ruler? What if they are oppressed? Or what if they are denied unfairness? Like what Judy said, eventually God will judge. And in the meantime, all we can do is what the Lord commands us to do in terms of being civil servants, civil citizens, if you will. So the danger of losing faith, we see so much unfairness. This danger of questioning God, it can lead one, if he or she is not careful, to giving up their faith and just chucking it all, if you will, and say it doesn't matter anymore. Well, this idea of the supreme ruler who is actively involved, does that not describe God? Is he such a ruler? He is. Turn to Hebrews 4 and verse 13. This made me think of a couple of New Testament passages. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 13. Ralph, when you have that, read that verse for us, please. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. There's no creature hidden from his sight, but all things are naked and open to the eyes of him to whom we look at his countenance.
So, what are the activities of God as described in this verse as ruler? Is there anything that's done behind the closed door he doesn't know about?
He's aware
of everything. It's as if we were just laid open for him bare, naked, exposed every part of us. God has that kind of knowledge. And we have to give an account. There'll be an accounting given. That leads us to think about 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10. We all must appear before the judgment seat of Christ. So we have such a ruler. Now, our president may not be that way. Our governor may not be that way. Our mayor may not be that way in a civil sense. That may be the case. He may not be the king that cultivates his own field. But earlier in verse 8, what's the chain of command? Everybody's got a boss, right? Everybody answers to somebody. And over all is God. So don't let that cause you to jettison your faith, throw it off to the side and say, well, it doesn't matter because things are so corrupt, so evil, so ungodly that it just doesn't make any sense to believe anymore. We can't come to that conclusion. Yes, sir? Yes. Now, what would it, and that's interesting that you say that, Ralph. What would it indicate on the part of a Christian if he or she were to lay awake at night worrying about the state of the city under Mayor Williams, or the state of Alabama under Governor Riley, or the state of this country under President Obama? We just get all worked up in a tizzy over that. We don't have faith. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't need to be active citizens. We need to be aware of things. I'm not saying go out and be an ostrich and put your head in the sand. I'm not saying that at all. But what's the principle we learned from Daniel 4? I didn't put this on the chart, but what was it that Daniel reminded Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 4? And that he does what? He raises up leaders and takes them down at his pleasure, at his discretion. So you're only here for a short time. If you rule a province, if you rule a municipality, whether it's a local or a national level, or in the case of the Bible days, they were world empires. They just didn't rule one country, they ruled all over. Got to remember that you're not ultimately in charge. You answer to somebody higher than you. And so don't lose faith, despite the fact that you see these puzzling, heartbreaking things that fly right in the face of things like justice and fairness and equity, godliness, those kinds of things. That would be a danger that Solomon warns us about. All right, now this is verses 10 to 17. This is the third danger he talked about. That is the danger of becoming materialistic. We see all this puzzling thing out here, all these puzzling, problematic areas. And so one may be led to think, well, I'm just going to go out there and get mine. And I'm going to live above that. That's not going to bother me because if I'm materialistically secure, if I'm wealthy enough, I don't have to worry about who's in charge. I'm covered. Do folks live that way? They do, don't they? Today, can we find folks that way? Easily. We can easily find people who have that kind of mindset. So this is the warning now he gives us. All right, look at verses 10 and 11. Ecclesiastes 5, 10 and 11. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage to their owners except to look on? Or the marginal note in verse 11 says to set their eyes on these things. All right. We see people who say, in essence, they may not say it with their mouths, but how they choose to live, they see security in material wealth. That's really the only place you can put your feet in that area and stand secure and firm if you have wealth. Because no matter what happens, you've got the material resources to ride out any kind of storm that comes. Do you hardly ever see rich people oppressed? Well, you don't really. Why? Well, they're not needy. They think they've got what they need. In fact, really, who is typically the oppressor? It's the rich man. It's the wealthy. All right, you hardly ever see rich people deny justice, do you? It happens, I know, but generally speaking, no? Because why? If they're crooked enough, they'll Yeah, they'll grease my palm. I mean, justice is for sale anymore in some places. So typically, again, you don't see the rich being denied justice. It's the fellow who doesn't have the wherewithal to defend himself or to take his issue to court and try to gain the civil victory. In fact, in many cases, he's the one who's denied justice. So, again, people who adopt this kind of lifestyle, they think that's where the security is. Yes. Yes. Because people will flock to the well because a lot of folks live that way. So Solomon says, okay, if you love money, the warning is you're not going to be satisfied with it. Why? Because you'll want more. There's never enough. You'll never reach the plateau that says, okay, I have finally arrived at this level of wealth and income. I am satisfied. What's that little thing that takes over eventually? It's called greed. Right? Greed is so appealing. Anybody immune from greed? Nobody. Colossians 3 and verse 5 says that beware of greed, which is idolatry. Or covetousness, which is idolatry. It can become an idol to us. So loving it... I'm sorry, go ahead. Yes. Right. It is. And in terms of life on earth, now in terms of life on earth, the person that's got the, he can take his wealth and kind of pile it up in a heap there and say, okay, that's mine. The fellow over here doesn't have that, so in this realm, there could be an advantage. But in the grand scheme of things, what's the advantage? There is none. It's only to use here. Can't be taken out of this world and used elsewhere. And certainly we're never encouraged to use material wealth in an unholy or dishonorable way. It's to be used for righteous or godly purposes. So Ralph is correct. The last part of verse 11 somewhat is ironic in what it says. What advantage is it, really, if you consume these things, to get them to consume them, and your appetite for them increases as your possession increases? The only advantage is you have this a bigger pile to look at and to use, and that's really all you can do with it. You can't make it last any more than that. Now, he's already warned of this previously, and in fact, I hope you've been impressed with, as you go through the book and you read these things and look at some of the questions I'm asking, to me it almost seems redundant to keep going back and keep talking about materialism, the material wealth. Well, that's because it's a lot in this book. That's why this book is so timely, written so long ago, but it could have been written today, and it would fit our culture just the same as it did in Solomon's day. So back in chapter 2, verses 8 through 11, you can glance back there really quick and see that he's already talked about the folly, the futility, the vanity of pleasure and possessions. Remember the things that he says he collected? He heaped up for himself wealth and gold and silver. We went back and read in the Kings and the Chronicles record. In the days of Solomon, how prevalent was gold? As if rocks laying on the ground. Money was just flowing into the kingdom faster than they could count it. It was everywhere material wealth was. So he has already warned of this kind of lifestyle. But now back in chapter 5, what is the answer? To not give in to materialism, to avoid that, you have to have a mindset that counters it. What's the mindset? Verse 12. Is it not contentment? Look at verse 12. The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much. The full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. Now, look at the contrast. The working man, and by that I think he means the man who doesn't have much, just the common, ordinary man, not the rich man. He can eat little or much. But when it says the full stomach of the rich man, how much does he eat? Just by that statement. He eats a lot. And again, why? Well, obviously, because he has the means to live that way. But why is the working man's sleep pleasant? And why is the rich man's sleep, why does it evade him? Why does he not get to sleep? The way they look at their wealth? Yes, he's worried about it. That's right. Well, isn't that true? Or somebody come in and take it from him. That's right. He's got to find out, okay, now how can I increase my portfolio? How can I protect it? How can I increase it? How am I going to do tomorrow? All these things, he just becomes consumed by it. And the working man, he doesn't have much. But he's used to that. He's learned to be content. Now, can a working man be greedy? Can a poor man be a materialist? Yes, he can. If he desires to become rich, he's no better off than the one who's already rich. In fact, we'll get to 1 Timothy 6 in a moment. I've often thought, in fact, let's go ahead and turn there. There's two statements I want you to look at. If you've not marked them in your Bible, I think it's good to at least notice these, whether you underline things in your Bible or not, would be really irrelevant. But we always compare verse 9 to verse 17. There's a phrase in each verse, and they are linked together. Verse 9 addresses who? 1 Timothy 6, verse 9 talks to who? Those who desire to be rich. See that? Those who want to be rich. Verse 17 talks to who? Those who are rich. So you have those who are already wealthy, their talk, some things in verse 17. But you would have somebody who's not rich, but they sure would like to be. They want to be. So in the text, Paul addresses both kinds of people. So a poor man can be just as guilty of materialism as the rich man. If he so desires to live that kind of lifestyle, then he's no less a materialist than the one who's already got the material wealth. But the idea here is contentment. The sleep of the working man, of the working contented man, will be pleasant, whether he's got a lot or none at all. He's learned to get by. He is not obsessed. If I understand this phrase correctly, he's not obsessed with gaining wealth. He's not obsessed at all. But his concern is providing for my family, having enough. And if I have enough, I'm happy with that. Yes, sir. Right. Yes. Well, that's true. I mean, he's writing from a perspective that none of us will ever have. I mean, he has been to the top of the wealth mountain, and nobody else has ever had what Solomon had. It's just not going to be possible. I don't think we can fully fathom the amount of wealth he had. It was just staggering. And he can say this because he has been there, as you say. But to contrast the contented working man, the materialist, even though his stomach is full, he can't really enjoy it because he is worried about gaining more. And the worries are not just about getting it, but then keeping it. I've worked so hard to get it, now I've got to work just as hard, if not harder, to make sure I don't lose it. Because to me, that's everything. You take a rich man who wants material wealth and he loses it, whether it's by his own fault or things outside his control. Basically, what will be his outlook on life then? If he thinks that's where life really is, and once that's gone, then what's he going to think? Why live? My life is over. I've got no reason to live anymore. Whereas the contented man knows there's other things that are at work here that are more important than how much wealth I own or how much wealth that I have. So, Solomon says, verse 13, hoarding up riches. So this is a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun. Riches being hoarded by their owner to what end? To his hurt, to his own hurt or their own hurt. When those riches were lost, this is verse 14. When those riches were lost through a bad investment. How does the King James read that? The new or the old? I'm through misfortune. Okay. So if it's evil travail, all right. So there are things that are happening in life that can certainly impact us all, whether you're wealthy or whether you're poor. And certainly, I mean, what's the state of our economy right now? I mean, we've been hurt, haven't we? I mean, everybody's taking a hit. We're all having to pay higher for this or that. I mean, we would be fools to not realize that there are some of us who have lost more than others. That's just the different levels of wealth that we each have. Some have taken a bigger hit, but we're all suffering in the current downtrend in the economy. So he's arguing here about forces that are at work in an economy that affect us all. And so when some wealth is lost through misfortune or bad investment, and if this materialist has fathered a son, there's an heir, and you have a misfortune that can wipe out a lifetime's work of saving and stockpiling, what's the heir of that one going to do? What's going to happen to him? He's not going to have anything. If that's all that's been focused on in such a family, son, all that matters is what you got in the bank account. And a lot of folks raise their children that way, don't they? All that matters is what you can get out of this life. Well, when this kind of bad misfortune happens, then what about that heir? What's that teaching you? There's no reason for living. But if you have contented families who may suffer economically, and we do, and maybe we lose some money too, but if we've taught our children well, what lesson will they learn then? We're content. Right, the Job's blessing. They all got wiped out. What did he say? The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. His heart was where it needed to be. Now, his fortunes were restored by the end of the book. That's not the point, though, but the point is his reaction to it was commendable. Satan said he would do what? See, he's a materialist, Jehovah. You've got him hedged in. You're protecting. You take that hedge away, and I guarantee you, that's who he is, that's how he defines himself, and he loses it. He's not the kind of man you say that he is. What did Job show? Yes, he is. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. It's all at the discretion of the Lord anyway. Well, that's true. That's true. Anybody can fall into that trap, brother. No, you're right. Well, that's true. That's true also. So the heirs of such a one, he says, will have nothing to fall back on. And it is a failed safety net. And I'm citing 1 Timothy 6, verse 17. The rich are not to trust in uncertain riches. It's all uncertain. I would like to cite Proverbs 23 and verse 5. Riches make themselves wings and they fly away. They're gone. They can do that so easily. Well, verses 15 through 16 of this chapter, I think Solomon is referencing certain laws, and I'm calling them that. That's my term. Certain laws that cannot be altered. What is the law he mentioned, or what's the unalterable truth in verse 15? Yes. You will not leave this world differently than you came in. Now, nobody can alter that truth. That's just the way it is. As he had come naked from his mother's womb, so will he return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. That's really an odd illustration, but I'll go with something I've already started. I'll go ahead and say it. Let's say we some rich man died and his family decided to put some indicator of his wealth in his hands as he's laying in the casket. A wad of cash or, I don't know, a piece of jewelry. Where's it going to go? It's going to go in the ground. That's where it's going to go. If you weren't in the adult class on Sunday, Buddy Pepper, man, we all chuckled when he said it was an astute observation. We were talking about the parable of the rich man and Lazarus in Luke 16. And we were talking about using just a little bit of speculation, if we could, to imagine the kind of funerals that both men had. both men died. We know the Bible tells us how they lived, their introspective lifestyles. And the funeral that Lazarus probably had was probably not much one at all. He was a poor beggar. He had nothing. And beggars were usually just dumped unnoticed in the potter's field. Nobody to mourn them. But as Jesus told that story, he said, after Lazarus' death, although if he didn't have any mourners to cry about his passing, he had somebody to assist him. Who was it? He had angels who carried him from his death to the bosom of Abraham. Then the rich man, we can only imagine what kind of funeral he would have had. I mean, pomp and pageantry. You can find in the Scripture, you can find occasions where there were such a thing as a, if I can use this term, a professional mourner. I mean, people were hired to be mourners and singers at the passing of someone wealthy. That's what they did back in Bible days. So we can imagine the procession to the graveyard. This man probably had a big tomb, a mausoleum. He was buried in the city in the tombs of his fathers. All this big to-do. But how far could the mourners go with the body? Only as far as the grave, and then that's it. The body stays right there. And no angels mentioned with respect to him in the parable. He stopped right there. And so, Buddy raised his hand and said, well, you know, I want to liken a marriage to a funeral. And I thought, well, where's he going to go with this? That's kind of dangerous, you know. He said, you can spend all this money on a wedding, thousands and thousands of dollars, or you go down to the courthouse and pay a couple of $100 to a judge, and both couples are just as married. And that's true. He said, you can spend thousands and thousands of dollars upon a funeral, have the family spend all this, or you can be buried in a pine box. He said, either way, you're in the ground with dirt on top of you. And that's true. You're in the ground, you're planted, you're underneath the dirt, and that's where you are. And that's true. So what he's saying here is that you will leave this world penniless. All of us will. You may have a stockpile of wealth, but you can't take it with you. So verse 16, he says, and this also is a grievous evil, exactly as a man is born, thus will he die. So the question is, what is the profit or what is the advantage to him who toils for the wind? To live this kind of materialistic lifestyle is to grasp or toil for the wind. What is your profit in living that way when it's all said and done? Haven't you wasted your time? You've wasted your entire life living that way because you can't take it with you. Absolutely wasted. So we see these general type warnings. And look at verse 17 as we conclude this particular section. He says, throughout his life, he also eats in darkness with great vexation, sickness, and anger. What happens? Such a one, but even before he dies, if he loses his wealth, what kind of life will he have if he's lost the lifestyle to which he's accustomed? Can you worry yourself sick? I mean, a person can do that, can't they? They're just so wrapped up in this pursuit that they think is the answer to living, and when it's taken away from him or her, or it's lost through some. Go back again to verse 14. This misfortune that happens, even things that are beyond. I mean, say you make a bad decision and it's all your fault. Okay, that can happen, but even things that's beyond your control and it's taken away. And if that's what we're wrapped up in, we can worry ourselves into a grave, couldn't we? We could fret ourselves in, affect our mental health, our physical health, spiritual health. Any of us know Christians who we thought were strong, we would have said, I wouldn't have ever thought that kind of person, he or she, would fall away. But things went bad for them in life and they became unfaithful. Have you known people that way? It happens, doesn't it? See, not even Christians are immune from this. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When Jesus said, "What will a man give in exchange for his own soul?" In fact, he went to what extreme? Even if you gain the whole world, if you could gain every cent of wealth that's known to exist in the cosmos, which no man ever will. Not even Solomon owned everything. He owned more than anybody ever will, but he didn't own everything. But even if you could own it all, Jesus said it's still a bad trade to forfeit your soul, to exchange or trade your soul for it. It's a bad deal. No. But think you're right, Brother Miller. But, you know, why is it that God doesn't tell us when we're going to die? You ever thought about that? Why is that hidden? Well, we don't know, but could it be a test of faith? See how much you're really going to trust me. Because if I knew how things were going to work out, see, if I could know and arrange my own future, then I'm the one that's in charge. Then I've got no reason, I've got no use for God, because I'm in control. You know, I've likened this before to somebody who thinks that he or she always has to drive the car. I can't ride. I've got to be the one driving the car. What about that kind of person? They've got control issues. Well, we're not the ones driving. God is. And he hides things from us, I'm convinced, as a matter of test of faith. Do you believe me enough? Do you trust me enough that you'll walk by the precepts that I've given you in my word? I put this in here. I mean, I want you to think about the continual references to materialism in this book and the numerous times, at least up to this point, we have referenced 1 Timothy 6. Have you been paying attention to that? I mean, it seems like it's almost happening every class. But I'm not apologizing for that. I'm not. That's why I'm saying this is such a timely book. It's the warnings that we need to hear the most. This is the danger, the prevalent danger facing the church today is worldliness and materialism. It's just eating us alive. Christians are just running headlong into the chopper blade and not thinking a thing about it. And it's just killing us. So, we see all these references to this. And we keep... And we'll keep citing those particular verses. So again, he gives us the danger of materialism. And it's easily supported by New Testament passages like 1 Timothy 6. And we keep going to that. Okay. Last two questions, page 13. This is the conclusion to this particular section. And again, I say this is another reach above the sun. Again, that's my phrase, to contrast it to under the sun, which is throughout the book. I think this is the second time he's done this. The first reach above the sun was at the end of chapter 2, verses 24 through 20. In fact, let's go back and read that real quickly. I'll do this for a reason. Chapter 2, verses 24 through 26. Again, let's not lose sight of the overall outline of the book. The first two chapters, verses... Chapter 1, verse 12 through chapter 2, verse 23, were Solomon's experiments. This is where he tried to find the answer. He was searching. What is the meaning of life? Where can I find the answer? Where can I find the purpose for living? And he took us through all those things that he did. His wealth, his possessions, his women, his wisdom, all those things. And they all came up empty. Chapter 2. Verse 24. Paul, would you read for us, please, 24, 5, and 26 of chapter 2. Okay, thank you. So the conclusion Solomon gave us was, what about your blessings in life? What did he mainly say? Enjoy them. Don't depend on them. Where do they come from? They're a gift from God. So enjoy them. Enjoy the fruits of your labor without going to an extreme and making them the focus of your life. But enjoy them. Now that was the main message. All right, chapter 5 now. Verse 18, this ought to sound very familiar. John, do some reading for us, please. Read verses 18, 19, and 20 of Ecclesiastes 5. Does that sound familiar? It's the second time he's reached above the sun for this divine wisdom. And in context of what he's been talking about here, chapter 3 through chapter 5, Solomon admits those truths about God, yes. Then he admits, but I see these puzzles. I see these problems in life that just seem to argue against the very sovereign control of Jehovah. That's chapter 5. Chapter 3, 16 through the end of chapter 4. And chapter 5, 1 through 18. Here's the dangers of questioning God. So what's the conclusion? What's the second reach above the sun? Same wisdom. If you have blessings in life, what are you told to do? Enjoy them. They come from the hand of God. Don't make them to be the end of life. Don't make that the end all of life, the purpose, the reason for living. They are gifts of God. So despite the puzzling realities in life, and we see them, don't be shocked, he said, if you see oppression and injustice. We wish that wasn't so. God wishes that there be no oppression and injustice. But he's given us the chance to have free will. He's given us the opportunity to make our own decisions. And if I choose to be wicked and oppressive, then that's my choice. I can do that. I'll answer for it, but I can do it. And other people will suffer if I make that sinful mistake. But even though we see these puzzles, these unsolvable riddles to us, he still says, be thankful for what you've got. Be encouraged to live a fruitful, faithful life. Put your trust in who? God, and not in yourself or others or your things. Look at Psalm 118. I think that's the right passage. Psalm 118, yeah, verse 8. Just a short little statement that's got power to it. Angela, read for Psalm 118 and verse 8. All right, there we go. It's better to take refuge or trust in the Lord or God than to put your faith and confidence in men. What happens when you put your faith or your trust in men? Every time, right, Freda? They'll let you down every time. It will always be a mistake. But if you put your faith and trust in God, He'll never let you down. You'll never be sorry that you did that. Yes. At the end of Matthew 6, that great discussion of do not worry about these things. What am I going to eat? What am I going to wear? Where am I going to live? Seek first the kingdom. And these things will take care of themselves. So some very powerful teaching here. We need to enjoy our gifts from God. Like Angela said a few moments ago, not turn them into the reason, the purpose for living, but be thankful for them. Riches are sure to fail, aren't they? Is that what he says? Riches are sure to fail. He said that earlier in this text. Luke 16, verse 9. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 17, all these passages. The one who has learned the lesson of calm enjoyment in life will not concern himself with how long or how short life is to enjoy the fruits of his labor. Look at the first part of verse 20 of Ecclesiastes 5. He says, for he will not often consider the years of his life. That means, well, I didn't get to be rich very long. Over here, he was rich for three times as long as I was. The godly man's not going to think that way. That's not going to be his concern. It's not how many years that we have to enjoy it. It's what we do with it while we have it. That's the concern. That's what we need to be focusing on. So, as this particular section comes to a close, look at the last part of verse 20 of Ecclesiastes 5. He'll be able to enjoy these possessions. He says, God will keep him occupied with the gladness of his heart. It made me think about Philippians chapter 4. We'll look at the last part of verse 20 in a moment. Solomon says that, you know, he's fixed his hope on God, not upon his possessions. But let's close with this passage in Philippians chapter 4. And I can't think of a better illustration of this very point than Paul's words here. Let's set the stage here. From where is Paul writing Philippians? From prison. First Roman imprisonment. And I'm jumping in here at verse 10. Paul says, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last your care for me has flourished again. Now, if you just stop right there, that sounds like Paul is saying what? Yeah, your gift finally got here. I've been waiting, looking for it, and it never did come, but now, I'm glad your money finally got here. Well, that's not what he's saying. You keep reading the context and you'll find that out. The last part of verse 10. Though you surely did care, you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak in regard to need. See, where was Paul's focus? Not on things. For I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. So when Paul had earthly sustenance, what was his attitude? What Solomon says here. Thankful for it. When he didn't have it, remember all those places in 2 Corinthians 11, he said, I've been in all these perils, all these dangers. There were times Paul didn't have it. Wonder what his attitude was then. Well, where are those Philippians? That's not what he said. I learned how to be content. I put my trust in God, not in things. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Nevertheless, you have done well, that you have shared in my distress. Now you Philippians know also that in the beginning of the gospel, when I departed from Macedonia, that no church shared with me concerning giving and receiving, but you only. For even in Thessalonica, you sent aid once and again for my necessities. Not that I seek the gift, but I seek the fruit that abounds to your account. See, what was Paul more concerned about? Getting the money from them or them? I seek what will amount to your account in helping me. That's what I'm more concerned about. We get that from verse 18. Indeed, I have all and abound. Now, there you go. Here's a man sitting in the jail. He says, I have all. How many times do you and I sit here and wonder and bemoan and we complain, I don't have enough? Makes you kind of feel ashamed, doesn't it? It does me. I don't have that kind of attitude. I need to do better about that. Paul says, I am full, having received from Epaphroditus the things which were sent from you, a sweet-smelling aroma, an acceptable sacrifice, well-pleasing to God. And my God shall supply all your need according to His riches in glory in Christ Jesus. Now to our God and Father be glory forever and ever. Amen. There is an attitude of the man who's doing exactly what Solomon says to do. Was he where he was unfairly? That's right, he was. He had had to make his appeal to Caesar because he's being mistreated unfairly by the Jews at Caesarea. Unfairly charged. No evidence to support the indictment, if you will. He hadn't done anything that they said he had done. Yet he still said, I'm full. I thank my God. I'm trusting in Him. This is exactly the kind of thing Solomon's talking about here. So such a one, verse 20 concludes. He says, he will not often consider the years of his life because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. So there's the end of the second section. Put your faith and trust in God, not in these things. Even though you see puzzling, distressful inequities in life, we can't let that discourage us and keep us from serving the Lord. All right. Any other closing thoughts or comments anybody has? Observations? All right. You have the new material. The Lord willing, next Tuesday we'll start Lesson 5, which gets us to Chapter 6 and Verse 1. Thank you for your comments and your participation today.